Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, July 29th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, KMUD provides latest updates on Medicine and Berry fires, continued coverage on the Orleans complex. Seven local Humboldt restaurants receive a $5,000 grant from PG&E Corporation Foundation, and Eureka launches a new plan to help meet the state-mandated housing deadline. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region. On Monday afternoon, just after 3 p.m., a full wildland fire resource response was dispatched after a vehicle fire spread to a nearby vegetation near the Humboldt-Trinity County line on Highway 36. Local and CAL FIRE resources from Humboldt and Trinity counties, as well as resources from the Six Rivers National Forest, promptly responded to the scene of what has been named the Berry Fire. When firefighters arrived, the fire was estimated to be about 5 acres, with a moderate rate of spread, burning in grass and timber. There were no structures immediately threatened. The Six Rivers National Forest posted on their Facebook last evening, quote, "Huge shout out to our Six Rivers National Fire crews on the Mad River Ranger District for their incredible work on the Berry Fire. Thanks to a swift and aggressive full suppression response, with support from our partners, crews were able to stop the fire's upslope run and kept the blaze at about 11 acres before it grew into a larger incident. Their actions protected not only the forest but our communities as well. The cause of the fire is still under investigation, but early signs point to a parked vehicle as the source. Let this serve as a strong reminder, spark safety, not wildfires. We don't want any human-caused wildfires on our forests and public lands, and you can help prevent them," end quote. In northeastern Mendocino County, on Sunday afternoon, a fast-moving fire sparked along Rifle Range Road, north of Refuse Road in Covelo. Dubbed the Medicine Fire, by Tuesday afternoon, CAL FIRE reported the fire had burned at 263 acres, with firefighters accomplishing a 47% containment. Fire resources continue to extinguish hotspots and strengthen perimeter control lines. Some evacuation orders were issued on Sunday, but had been lifted by later Sunday evening. Farther from home, burning to our northeast, a few miles from Orleans, just across the Humboldt County line in Siskiyou County, the Butler Fire portion of the Orleans complex continues to burn. First reported back on July 6th, the Butler Fire was last mapped at over 21,000 acres. Containment had increased to 47% by this morning. Evacuation orders and warnings remain in place for residents in and around the community of Forks of Salmon. You can visit the Siskiyou County Sheriff's webpage or Facebook page for details, or go to protectgenesis.com, that's protect.genas.com, to see the evacuation map. Forest Road and Truro closures remain in place throughout the area. See the webpage for Six Rivers National Forest or the Siskiyou County Sheriff's Office Facebook page for additional information. Tune in to KMUD for continuing coverage of our local 2025 fire season experience. Seven locally owned restaurants in Humboldt County will receive a financial boost through grants from the California Restaurant Foundation and the PG&E Corporation Foundation. These grants are aimed at helping restaurants invest in equipment upgrades, workforce training, and other critical needs, all designed to support their continued operation and long-term success. Restaurants Care is a program of the California Restaurant Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit that has been supporting California's food and beverage community since 1981. Originally launched in 2017 as a safety net for food and beverage workers, the program expanded in 2021 to also support independent restaurants. Restaurant Care offers vital stability to the individuals and businesses at the heart of California's dynamic culinary scene. The PG&E Corporation Foundation, not to get it confused with PG&E, the PG&E Corporation Foundation supports programs designed to promote education, environmental stewardship, and directed to serve underserved communities. KMUD News spoke with Megan McFarlane, part of the marketing and communications team for PG&E, to discuss more of what this financial boost means for restaurants locally in Humboldt County.
Right after this pandemic in 2021, we knew that so many locally owned restaurants in our service area were struggling. So we partnered with the California Rest Foundation to start this program where we would give $5,000 grants to locally owned restaurants throughout our service area. We prioritize minority and women-owned businesses, and the grants are about $5,000 each. And so far, this program has been so popular. We have had so many applicants, and it's wonderful to be able to give back to these locally owned restaurants in our communities. Like I said, it started in 2021 after the pandemic, but it's been so popular that we're on our fifth year now. We give the grants so that these smaller restaurants can invest in their equipment, upgrades, workforce training, you know, whatever they think that they need to help their business and their community thrive. You know, we recognize that many of these locally owned restaurants are within our communities. It's where our customers love to gather, to celebrate, to make memories. So what we can do to help them helps the whole community.
Cafe Brio, a local restaurant in Arcata, was one of the recipients of the $5,000 grant. Tamara Tafoya, the office manager, took the initiative to apply for the funding. She shared how they first learned about the opportunity and described their excitement upon hearing the news that they had been selected.
We found out about this grant because PG&E contacted us to do something that's called Coffee Connection. And what they did, I believe it was in April, they came to our cafe and for the first hour or possibly 2 hours of the day, they bought everybody their drinks, their coffee drinks. And they set up in our dining room with their staff and their computers, and they invited the community to come in, ask questions about their utility bills or have them analyze their bills. And a lot of people came. I mean, they were really, really busy and really helpful. So I met Megan, and she is the one that told us about the grant possibility. And so I applied. We were completely excited and happy and really thrilled because, it was a $5,000 grant. And our PG&E bill is around $5,000 a month. We operate 7 days a week and close only for three holidays each year. So our energy use is kind of super high. So that's what we applied. We used it to pay 1 month's bill for PG&E. So essentially we gave it back to them.
At PG&E, McFarland emphasizes the importance of supporting small restaurants and local business owners through these grants. She explains that the company aims to move away from corporate-driven initiatives and focus more on meaningful community engagement.
We just know that within these smaller communities, that's where like our customers are going. That's where they go to see their friends. That's where they, go to get coffee, go to get a good meal. And PG&E has really taken a more regional approach in the past several years. We're trying to show up in each region rather than how we used to be structured where things were based out of PG&E's headquarters. So it's part of giving back to our hometown. So we're trying to show up more prominently in our communities where our customers are.
Tafoya builds on McFarland's comments, offering a small business perspective on the significance of the grant, particularly post-pandemic.
Well, since the pandemic, I think all businesses are facing some of the challenges and, trying to return to profitability. But, as a cafe, there's only so much we can do. I mean, we've shortened our hours, we've reduced our labor costs, we've reworked our menus to be more cost-effective. And we've also been improving our customer service, but those are the only things we can really control. Rent, all our overhead costs continue to rise. And so I think along with other businesses, that's been a big issue for our company, are those operational costs that we really don't have control over. So the grant really helped us, bridge some of the gaps. Because, $5,000 for a small business means a lot.
Although the grant was used to cover the bill at Cafe Brio that month, Tafoya explains that it provided them with valuable time to focus on making improvements to the cafe.
I would say that by receiving this grant, it has allowed our cafe to have a little extra money to make improvements that we possibly wouldn't be able to do otherwise. Or we would have to wait to make some improvements. We've been trying to beautify our patio. That's one example. So by having this $5,000 grant, it kind of helps to offset some of our other expenses. And we're really, you know, we're really, really grateful for that. And we're just trying to make the cafe a more comfortable and beautiful place for our customers.
The use of the grant is entirely at the discretion of the restaurant owners, allowing them to reinvest in their employees and give back to the community.
So we leave it up to the restaurant, but we encourage them to spend it on equipment, technology upgrades, unforeseen hardships that, you know, might be impacting the restaurant, employee retention, bonuses, training to help the restaurant owners invest back in their business and the people. We give the grants to California resident restaurant owners with fewer than 5 locations and less than $3 million in revenue. And like I said, we prioritize minority and women-owned businesses.
The PG&E Foundation has contributed $1.1 million to support 188 local restaurants across 29 counties within PG&E's service area, including several in Humboldt. Each restaurant is receiving a $5,000 grant, with the Community Resilience Fund managing the program. The funding comes directly from PG&E shareholders, not customers. Restaurants receiving the grants are Adele's Restaurant in Eureka, Cafe Brio Arcata, Cafe Phoenix in Arcata, Patsy's Klein Parlor Lounge in Eureka, Slice of Humboldt Pie Arcata, The Green Lily in Eureka, and lastly, T's Brunch Club in Arcata. For more information on the California Restaurant Foundation, Restaurants Care, or the Restaurant Resilient Fund, the website is restaurantscare.org. Eureka Builds It is a unique new plan to set launch this fall to help homeowners build accessory dwelling units on their property while helping the city avoid possible fines and other repercussions for failing to meet the state's mandated housing deadline. Sigur Bjorn reports.
Humboldt County has a mandate from the state of California to build 3,390 new housing units before the end of 2027 to alleviate the state's housing shortage. This mandate has sent the county and towns within it scrambling to identify possible building sites within their domains, the city of Eureka among them.
Eureka's sub-goal is 952 new units in that time period.
That's Kristen Kenyon, Eureka's Development Services Director, speaking to KMUD about the city's race to complete its housing mandate before the deadline, which is only 2.5 years away.
952 is also then divided up into different income levels. So for instance, we have a goal of 402 above moderate housing units built. And we have, for our very low and low income, we have a goal of a total of 378.
KMUD reported on the progress of the low and very low income units a week ago. They include the housing being built by the Wiyot tribe, 3 link housing projects, and the upper floors of the regional transit hub Danco Construction is building on 3rd Street.
We also need market rate and above market rate housing. We have identified privately owned sites for those market rate units.
The state can punish cities and counties with fines if they don't meet their set deadline of delivering housing before the end of year 2027. In light of this, does Kenyon feel confident that Eureka will meet the deadline in 2.5 years?
No, no. So if we look at a goal of 952 new homes in 8 years, then we're striving for 119 homes every year, new homes every year. And right in the last 6 years, we've only been averaging 44 new homes a year. So we are not building housing at the pace we need to meet our overall regional housing needs allocation.
That's not such great news. Given that the city could stand to be fined up to $50,000 per month for each violation of the state mandate. However, it's not really for the lack of trying that Eureka is falling behind its goal. Like the cities of Elk Grove, Coronado, and Huntington Beach, who have flat out refused to comply with the mandate.
We comprehensively updated our zoning code in 2019, and we removed a lot of barriers to housing. And we really have seen a jump in the number of units being developed in the last 3 years.
A particular focus has been placed on changing the zoning code to allow for ADUs, or accessory dwelling units to be built on existing single unit lots.
We're getting over 20 accessory dwelling units every year. So that's helping a lot. We're also working on a Eureka Builds It program where the city's going to finance affordable housing development on privately owned sites.
Eureka Builds It is a unique program conceived by the city's staff in which homeowners who are interested in building ADUs on their lots can access city resources and knowledge to get their ADUs built. This includes assistance with finding city-approved designers and contractors, and generally have the city's staff guide them through the building process. In some instances, financial assistance is also available, and the Eureka Builds It program has been approved for $600,000 in city funding, most of it derived from the American Rescue Plan Act, but also $100,000 per year allocation of income from short-term rental taxes. Additionally, Eureka is hoping for a matching $500,000 funding through the state's Local Housing Trust Fund. Within the city limits, Eureka has around 5,000 single-unit parcels that now, after a change in the zoning code, qualify for an ADU to be added. As Christine Kenyon points out, the demographics and family sizes have drastically changed since the bulk of homes in Eureka were built.
We have so many lots that have just one house on them, but have room for an accessory dwelling unit. It's a place where we have a lot of untapped potential to build more housing. Household makeup is steadily headed towards smaller household sizes. You know, it's like over 70% are two or less, no kids. And then out of that, like 30-something percent is just single-person households.
Roughly 25% of the Housing Trust Fund will be dedicated to low and very low income affordable housing, leaving 3/4 of it to go towards the income brackets above it. However, with a fund that is likely to start with somewhere between $500,000 and $1 million, there are only so many projects the city can support financially. Swan Ashbury, Eureka's economic development manager, says the city will likely start by financing 2 to 3 accessory dwelling units.
I think it's going to depend on the cost of their construction estimate. So I'm guessing an ADU will cost about $150,000, and that will probably baby step with doing 2 to 3 to begin with.
Here is Kristin Kenyon explaining what happens once the initial 2 to 3 units have been built.
We're hoping that they can refinance with the bank, we can get the money back, and then we can use it to help somebody, loan it to somebody else for another accessory dwelling unit.
While Eureka Builds It offers a way for the city to increase the number of housing units within the city limits, helping a handful of homeowners build ADUs on their lots will still leave the city far short of filling its state-mandated housing quota. The state has been taking a tough stance on cities who are not compliant. The above-mentioned cities of Elk Grove and Coronado have given in and agreed to build their share of affordable housing, while the Orange County city of Huntington Beach is locked in a protracted court battle with the state. Given this, is Kristin Kenyon concerned that a similar fate may await the city of Eureka?
Not necessarily. The state is really focused on you developing a plan with implementation measures for how to meet your regional housing needs allocation and following through with those implementation measures. So they have been following up with me, checking on us to make sure we've done all of our implementation measures. There are nuanced consequences to not meeting the RENA, but the more important part is showing your work, showing that you have adequate space, and working steadily towards that goal during your housing element.
The city of Arcata plans to launch a similar plan, and the county is keeping a watching brief on the progress. This is Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUD.
In state news, Senator Padilla introduces legislative update to expand path to citizenship for millions, KPFA's Dahlia Lozier reports.
Democratic Senator Alex Padilla of California has announced legislation to expand a pathway to lawful permanent residency for millions of long-term U.S. residents. It's a move he says will counter President Donald Trump and Stephen Miller's demonization of undocumented immigrant communities. Community leaders joined Senator Padilla, including Angelica Salas, the director of the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights.
Of those being detained, the majority are Mexicans who had lived in this country for over 20 years. They are fathers, they are mothers of U.S. citizen children, and we also found out they are also grandparents of U.S. citizen grandchildren. Behind every arrest are mothers, or fathers, or wives, or husbands. They are daughters, their co-workers, their friends, their neighbors. They are all facing now the consequences of the terror and the loss of their loved ones.
The proposed legislation is not a new program. It is just an update to existing law, which offers a pathway to citizenship for residents who have lived in the United States for more than 7 years, contribute to their community, and don't have a criminal record. The original bill was passed in 1929 and last updated by Republican President Ronald Reagan. Padilla is simply proposing to amend the date in that law to reflect the same timeline for attaining citizenship that was used by Reagan. He says that this law could unlock green cards for millions of people.
No new bureaucracy, no new agency, just a simple date change to existing law to better reflect today's reality. By creating a rolling 7-year eligibility cutoff date to qualify for protections, we can carve out a better path forward for hardworking long-term immigrants. A better path forward for dreamers, for farm workers, for TPS holders, and other essential workers.
Senator Padilla has been outspoken in criticizing Trump's mass deportations and the unprecedented militarization and escalation of tensions by deploying National Guard troops and Marines to respond to peaceful protests in Los Angeles. Padilla has also introduced the Visible Act, a measure to require immigration enforcement officers to display clearly visible identification during public-facing enforcement actions. Last month, he led the Senate Democratic Caucus in demanding that President Trump immediately withdraw all military forces from Los Angeles and cease all threats to deploy the National Guard or active duty service members to American cities. Padilla spoke on the Senate floor following his forcible removal from Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's press conference, where he was thrown to the ground and handcuffed after attempting to ask a question. Padilla criticized the Trump administration, claiming that they are not trying to fix a broken immigration system.
Have they offered any plans or solutions?
No.
They want to exploit immigrants to justify their power grabs. And while it may be immigrants who they're targeting today, it's going to be citizens tomorrow. The focus may be Los Angeles today, but it's going to be all across the country tomorrow. And while they may be focused on protesters today, they've laid the foundation to go after any type of dissent anywhere in the country tomorrow.
Senator Padilla's bill will be introduced into the Senate on Monday. Congressmember Zoe Lofgren of California will be introducing companion legislation into the House. For KPFA News, I'm Dahlia Lozier.
In National Native News, Brian Bull reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. With a stroke of a pen Thursday, President Trump has rescinded more than $1 billion in Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds. Buffalo's Fire reports this loss will hit both large operations, including Koahnic Broadcasting, and especially small stations, including KUHB on St. Paul's Island in the Bering Sea. Such stations are tribally centered in their talk, music, and news programming, and managers are hard-pressed to know how to replace the lost funds while preserving culture and traditions. An app developed by a former NPR employee called Adopt a Station shows stations who've lost more than half their funding. Users can contact these stations and make a donation. an Arizona tribal chairman, is the subject of a federal probe. But as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the reason behind why is still unclear.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs confirms its missing and murdered unit is investigating White Mountain Apache Chairman Casey Velasquez. The unit's special agents look into active cases, among other duties. A former tribal policeman, school administrator, and substance abuse counselor, Velasquez was first elected chairman in 2022 and also heads the Arizona Indian Gaming Association. His legal counsel, Kurt Altman, says that Velasquez will not be making any statements out of respect for the ongoing investigation that he's fully cooperating with, adding that they look forward to a rapid conclusion. The chairman is up for re-election next year. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
A First Nation in Canada is cashing in on an artificial intelligence data center to build up its economy. Sol Traverso reports.
The Woodland Cree First Nation is building an AI data center on its traditional territory in Alberta. The project will convert a partially completed power plant into a 650-megawatt natural gas-powered data center. Isaac Labocon Avram is the chief of the Woodland Cree First Nation. He wants to find other means to build a self-sufficient economy.
You have to be diverse, right? Like, we just don't want to rely on oil and gas and forestry. We want to see what we can be a part of wherever a solid opportunity is.
There's a push by world leaders for businesses to invest in AI. Canada recently appointed its first minister of artificial intelligence. And President Donald Trump says he wants to expedite building permits for AI data centers and for the U.S. to be a global leader in AI. John Horstman is the chief financial officer for Sovereign Digital Infrastructure.
Data centers and AI is, I think, a huge opportunity for productivity growth right across humanity, really, to access information, to enable people to kind of move faster, be smarter. What's really the limiting condition on the growth of AI is access to power.
Horstman is partnering with Woodland Cree to develop this data center. He says there's opportunities for First Nations and Indigenous communities with natural resources. Since data centers require a lot of fuel and water to power themselves, a single large data center can consume between 1 million and 5 million gallons of water a day. Chief Labocon Avram says they're going to be mindful of the environmental footprint this data center will have.
Us as a First Nation having majority control of it, we will definitely want to see the best in world-class environmental protections.
Labocon Avram did not want to speculate on any financial projections of the center, but said that this will be built over several years and expects to bring in hundreds of jobs.
I'm hoping it is a game changer. I want to pave our roads. I want to help out our elders in ways that we're not able to help them now. I want to invest in education, better housing, etc. So the hope of that is getting some of these economic development opportunities a chance.
For National Native News, I'm Sol Traverso.
And I'm Brian Bull from the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Sigur Bjorn, Dahlia Lozier, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@KMUD.org. Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.